rocks at the side of the boat. "What's going on?" Meyer asked Hauser, who shook his head and began moving through the control room, checking dials and asking questions. Heinrich shot a puzzled glance of concern at Meyer, who refused to return his gaze. "I think it's a moored mine chain scraping across our hull," hissed the sound man, tapping his headphones. The sound stopped as abruptly as it began, only to be replaced by a chilling word spat forth by the hydrophone operator. "Destroyer!" Langa had just raised the periscope and was looking around when he caught sight of the light gray bow of a warship slicing through the water directly toward U-505. He let out a strangled cry of warning before spinning around 360 degrees and slamming the scope into its well. "Crash dive, Chief! Down as fast as you can, 140 meters. Hard to port. Rig for silent running and prepare for depth charges." The strange metallic clinking sound was not a dragging chain, but machine gun bullets from two carrier-based aircraft that had spotted the outline of the U-boat gliding beneath the surface. They were firing into the water to mark the boat's position for the approaching destroyers, which were steaming at flank speed to reach the submarine. Heinrich took note of Langa's ashen face when the captain slid down the ladder into the control room. As men rushed through the room toward the bow of the boat, the skipper pulled Meyer and Hauser to the side and explained what he had seen. Given the cramped conditions, privacy was non-existent. "There are at least two fighter planes, three destroyers closing in fast, and in the distance maybe 3,000 to 4,000 meters an aircraft carrier." Heinrich's heart fell into his shoes. They had been discovered by a hunter-killer group. Gallery's task group, 22.3, was on its course to Algeria when USS Chatelaine reported a sound contact 3 miles from the carrier's position. The contact was only 800 yards from Chatelaine. The destroyer's captain changed course slightly and reduced his speed to 10 knots. "What do we have?" he asked. "Coming in loud and clear, sir, off our starboard bow," replied the sonar man. "I think it's a U-boat, but shallow." The range to the target was now only 600 yards and closing rapidly. Two planes skimmed the surface, stitching it with 50-caliber machine gun fire to alert the destroyer where the U-boat was. When the contact was confirmed as a submarine, general quarters bells rang throughout the ship, which steamed over the diving U-boat and dropped depth charges in an effort to rip her apart or blow her to the surface. Captain Gallery had found U-505. Newly promoted Lieutenant Buck Nelson gripped the starboard railing of the USS Pillsbury as he watched the Chatelaine lean in slightly to starboard as she increased her speed to reach the spot where the planes were tearing up the ocean. Fresh from the North African desert and no longer coaching baseball, Buck still felt uncomfortable in his role as damage control officer. His months of training had taught him well and he enjoyed his posting, but nothing had been as exhilarating as routinely beating the army team under a hot Tunisian sun, until now. Buck watched as the Chatelaine's K-guns fired 300-pound Torpex depth charges off the port and starboard sides of the ship. Massive 600-pound charges were rolled from the back of the ship. Buck watched with a slow smile spreading on his face when giant geysers of white and gray erupted 100 feet into the air. It took a few seconds for the sound of explosions to reach his ears. "Bastards," he muttered to no one in particular. "That's for Roncalais." He squeezed his eyes shut for a couple seconds to try to erase his memory of the boy's corpse and the bloody glove from his mind. A seaman standing by his side turned and asked, "Did you say something, sir?" Buck let out a long sigh and returned his thoughts to the present. "Just thinking of an old friend." Aboard the U-505, sentiments were a bit different. The boat was angling steeply by the bow and passing the 60-meter mark when the soundman announced, "Wasserbombs!" Heinrich gritted his teeth with the rest of his comrades as they waited for the depth charges to explode. "Brace yourselves," advised Langa, who stood calmly with one hand gripped around a ceiling pipe. A few moments later, a faint but distinct click was heard outside the hull, followed by a strong series of explosions that vibrated the boat without damaging it. The next series of detonations were closer. The last pair, however, were ear-splitting eruptions that shook U-505 vigorously from side to side. The blast knocked the men off their feet and seats, popped light bulbs, and opened a narrow but strong gush of water into the control room. Everything loose inside the submarine was sent flying against bulkheads. Blackness replaced the light as more explosions rocked the creaking hull. Heinrich remained at his station, as he was trained to do, while others shouted out orders. The first round of charges was over, but the boat had been damaged. How badly remained to be seen. It took nearly a minute before the emergency lights were turned on. None of the electric equipment was working. Try as he might, Heinrich could not stop the fear rising within. It was easy to imagine the seawater filling up beneath the deck plates, adding tons of weight that would soon make it impossible to bring the boat to the surface. The ocean floor was a mile below them. Additional bad news followed when the flooding of a more serious variety was discovered in the aft torpedo room. The news that sealed the boat's fate also arrived quickly. The main rudder was jammed. The U-boat was running in a tight circle, out of control. A quick conference of the officers confirmed the news and convinced Lange that there was only one choice available to him. "Blow all ballast," he yelled. "Prepare to surface and abandon ship." Heinrich turned to his friend Felix Kals, whose stoic calm was always a welcome sight. "Well, Kals, the war will be over for us in a few minutes, one way or the other." By this time, both the Pillsbury and Chatelaine were steaming in wide circles around the spot where the pattern of well-placed charges had been dropped. "There she is!" yelled someone. "There's the sub!" Buck turned to see the bridge of a U-boat rise from a mass of churning water. Widening circles of thick bluish-black diesel oil bubbled to the surface around the U-boat. The powerful Torpex had done its job. The Pillsbury's 50-caliber guns opened fire on the crippled submarine as soon as its guns could be brought to bear. Heavier weaponry was also thrown against it. The bullets and shells ripped ragged holes in the superstructure from aft to bow. 30 seconds after the submarine surfaced, a lone figure appeared on the bridge, doubled over, and fell out of sight. Another man popped up, staggered toward the rear of the bridge, and disappeared. Another minute passed, and then several men, one after the other, appeared topside. Unable to find sufficient shelter, they began jumping into the sea, more afraid of the bullets than the drowning. Although he did not know it, the first man Buck had seen was Harold Lange. As was the tradition aboard German U-boats, the captain was always the first man out. Lange had pushed aside the watch crew to climb out into either certain death or a crippling wound. The brave commander had scurried up the ladder to the main hatch, spun the handle, and pulled himself out of U-505 for the last time. Machine gun fire struck him on the leg and cut him down. First Officer Paul Meyer followed his skipper onto the bridge before he, too, was cut down. Heinrich was now standing with his other control room mates, the hydrophone and sonar operators, and a few men from the forward torpedo room. About a dozen other men had crowded into the control room, yelling and pushing to get up the ladder. Panic was setting in, and no one was around to instill order and regain control of the situation. "Where is Bray?" Felix yelled out to Heinrich above the din. Second Watch Officer Kurt Bray was nowhere to be found, just at the moment when leadership was most needed. "We have to scuttle the boat," Heinrich shouted back, looking around the control room for the chief. "Has the chief set the scuttling charges?" "I don't know," exclaimed Felix. "I think I saw him climb up the ladder." "How do we set the charges?" His usually calm voice had assumed a slightly hysterical pitch. At that moment, the stern of the boat began to sink several degrees. The submarine seemed poised to slip beneath the waves. If she did, everyone still aboard would ride her all the way to the bottom. "Go, get out!" ordered Hans Gobler, another control room mate, and one of the most experienced men on board. Hans had made every combat patrol aboard the U-505. He was a natural leader, and the men liked him. "I'll pull the plug in the sea strainer. That should sink her if the chief did not set the charges. Get out while you still can." The mad rush of frightened submariners, already underway, now became a stampede for survival through a single hatch in the conning tower. Felix grabbed Heinrich by the arm. "Come on, Heinrich, let's move before it's too late." Heinrich hesitated, looking back at Hans as he worked on the sea strainer. Hans saw his reluctance and screamed, "Go, Heinrich, I have this!" Hans removed the top of the strainer, held it up for his comrades to see, and threw it in the corner, confident his action had sealed the fate of U-505. "Let's get out of here!" Heinrich nodded and pushed his way forward with Felix, and then up the ladder. To their surprise, the conning tower was jammed full of men who refused to climb the last few rungs to the bridge, and for good reason. Screaming artillery rounds and thousands of bullets were slicing through the air and striking every foot of the U-boat bobbing above the waterline. Who wanted to trade the relative safety of the tower for the killing zone above or the cold sea below? Heinrich pushed his way up the ladder, believing that if he remained behind, the boat would take them all down. "Come on, Felix, this is our only chance." To Heinrich's surprise, he discovered Lange still alive on the bridge, but his leg was badly injured and bleeding profusely. Someone had tried to fashion a tourniquet out of a torn shirt. Several other wounded men were also there, but most had leaped into the water. Heinrich and Felix followed suit, holding onto the side of the U-boat to save their energy for what promised to be their final swim. And then, the firing stopped. "I think she's sinking," shouted a sailor on the Pillsbury. Buck watched in rapt fascination with hundreds of others from several warships as the stern of U-505 edged its way beneath the water. Soon, only the conning tower and most of the bow were still above water, and then only barely. "Yeah, she's done for," he replied. "Good, I hope she takes all those devils down with her, save us the trouble of having to waste bullets to kill them, or for food to feed them." That sentiment brought cheers from those standing nearby. To Buck's surprise, an order circulated to cease firing. It took a minute or so before every ship got the word, but the firing tapered fitfully to a close. Several whaleboats had been launched and were rowing toward the stricken submarine. In them were heavily armed sailors determined to capture U-505. "I'll be damned," he exclaimed. Captain Gallery wasn't kidding. 10 minutes later, one of the boats was tied up to the submarine, and several of the sailors, small arms, locked and loaded, scurried onto the bridge and inside the wounded machine. One was machinist mate Zenon Benedict Lacocious. After stumbling below, expecting any moment to hit a booby trap or have the boat drop out from beneath them, Lacocious found the cover of the sea strainer Gobler had removed and thrown it to one side. Lacocious replaced it on the opening of the pipe and ratcheted it shut. One source of water flooding into U-505 was sealed. To Lucosius's amazement, most of U-505 was dry. History remembers Gottfried Fischer as the only German sailor to die during the harrowing capture and boarding ordeal. Heinrich Müller, Felix Kals, Hans Gobler, and 55 other crewmen were plucked from the sea and quickly stowed away inside the aircraft carrier. Their only comfort was in believing that U-505 had sunk, and in doing so, had probably taken a few Americans with her. They could not have been more wrong. U-505 was captured off the coast of Africa on June 4, 1944. Heroic efforts by engineers and specialists who risked their own lives to preserve the boat kept her afloat. At times, water sloshed up and over the conning tower, and the stern threatened to drop away beneath the sea, risking those who labored inside. A line was hooked up to the USS Guadalcanal and U-505 was towed to Bermuda. The submarine was the first enemy ship boarded and captured by the U.S. Navy since the War of 1812. The capture of U-505 was one of the most significant events of the war. Contrary to what most of the Germans believed at the time, the scuttling charges had not been set, and the ship was not mortally wounded. Flooding turned out to be minimal, and the rudder had not been severely damaged. The confusion in the attack left the entire contents of the boat available for Allied review. This included a working, and priceless, Enigma decoding machine, complete with current code books. The Enigma code was what the Germans used to transmit important operational information. Gallery's bold plan had worked perfectly. The United States Navy kept the capture of the U-505 a state secret until after the end of the war. Chapter 15, Norfolk.
2 days after U-505 was captured, which was the same day the Allies liberated Rome, the invasion of northern Europe began at Normandy. Hours before the dawn landings on the beaches, thousands of paratroopers were dropped from the skies or landed in gliders. The drop was a giant mess, but the confusion and scattered nature of the landings also confused the Germans, who had no idea how to effectively respond to the Allies. The man tasked with defending Fortress Europa was Field Marshal Rommel, the same commander who had been flown out of North Africa by Hitler to prevent his capture or death. Everyone knew an invasion was coming. The question was where in northern France the hammer would fall. The most likely spots were Normandy and Calais. Rommel wanted to keep his armored divisions close to the front so they could respond quickly and drive the Allies into the sea. If a beachhead was formed and held, he knew that containing the Allied juggernaut would be impossible, and the war, for all intents and purposes, would be lost. Hitler and his theater commander, Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, were of a different mind. They wanted the armor held in more central locations, and then rushed to the point of attack. Without control of the skies, however, superiority was decidedly in the Allies' favor. Rommel knew enemy aircraft would make quick work of slow-moving tanks trying to roll their way toward the front along narrow French roads. When the beach invasion opened early on the morning of June 6, the resistance along most of the Normandy landing areas was light or non-existent. Fortune smiled on the Allies that day. Field Marshal Rommel had left Normandy for Germany to celebrate his wife's birthday. His armor remained concentrated far from the front. By the time the panzers were finally released later that day, they were too far away to do the Germans any good. Heavy fighting and serious casualties, however, were suffered along the stretch of sand tagged Omaha Beach. Unbeknownst to Allied planners, the Omaha defenses were manned by the 352nd Division, a largely veteran outfit with fighting experience from the Russian front. It took hours of bloody combat to secure the area and begin moving inland to expand the beachhead. Although Allied objectives for the first day passed largely unfulfilled, the tide had turned in Europe. The long, hard slog to Germany, however, was only just beginning.
A nudge on his shoulder woke Gene out of a deep sleep. He jumped up, still dazed, stumbling over his glove and spikes lying on the floor next to his bunk. "Who in the hell are you?" Gene demanded, leaping to his feet in surprise. "Shore Patrol, buddy. Are you Motor Mechanics Mate Gene Moore?" the tall sailor in the white helmet asked. "If I have to be." "Get dressed and follow me." "Where and why?" Gene asked. "You've pulled guard duty and you need to watch our POWs." Gene dressed in silence, wondering whether someone was pulling his leg. The war was far away, and they were in Norfolk, Virginia. "What prisoners of war could be here?" he muttered as he laced up his boots. The sailor stood by without speaking. Gene stood up, looked in the mirror, and said, "Okay, lead the way." He followed three SPs across the parking lot to a Quonset hut a few yards away. Inside were several of his teammates, each as confused as he was. "Have a seat, men," ordered a young but serious-looking lieutenant with the brightest and coldest blue eyes Gene had ever seen. The baffled ballplayers sat down noisily on wooden folding chairs arranged in front of the podium while the officer took up a station behind it. "Gentlemen, what I'm about to tell you is top secret. You can share this information with no one. Does everyone understand what I've just said?" Everyone nodded in agreement. The lieutenant had their full and undivided attention. "We have captured a large group of German sailors who will be transported to a remote camp in Louisiana with other Germans, mostly infantry. They will be held there, not as prisoners of war, but under a classified program that allows us to deny that we are holding them. They will not be allowed to mix with other prisoners, and they will not be allowed any contact with the outside world, period." The officer let the words sink in before continuing. "As far as the Krauts back in Berlin know, they are missing in action and presumed dead. I imagine by now that's what their relatives have been told. I can't tell you more than that now, but you have been selected to guard these men. We will be departing in 2 hours, so pack your sea bag and prepare to move out. These German POWs will be arriving in Louisiana in less than 1 week. We will hold them there until further notice. Again, let me remind you, this is absolutely top secret, and this intelligence is not to be shared with anyone, not your priest, not your mother, nobody." The officer paused again. "Are there any questions?" Jim Reardon was not convinced that a practical joke was not being played on them. Over the past 2 years, more elaborate hoaxes had been pulled on the team than he could count. "I smell a joke here, sir." "Where did you capture the German sailors in Louisiana? Mardi Gras?" A few chuckles rippled through the room. The lieutenant did not crack a grin. I don't joke at this time of the morning. I am not authorized to tell you anything more other than they are German, they are sailors, they will be in Louisiana. You are sailors in Uncle Sam's Navy, and you are being ordered to guard them. We have prisoners, and you will guard them. It's that simple. He looked at Reardon's teammates. Any other questions? Do they play ball? Gene asked. The room erupted in laughter. Even the blue-eyed lieutenant had to work hard to hide a smile. Well, no, I don't suppose they do play ball. Do you? He thinks he does, Lieutenant, shot out Milner, who reached out and punched Gene in the shoulder. I can't tell you anything more, gentlemen. Gene's hand shot up. Why us, Lieutenant? We're the baseball team. I don't think I've held a gun the entire time I've been in the Navy. I wouldn't know how to load one, let alone shoot one. If a German tried to escape, I don't think anyone on our team knows how to shoot. Gene looked over at Ray and asked, Have you ever shot anyone before? Ray screwed up his face into a scowl. Are you kidding? Never. Didn't you boys go through basic training? The lieutenant